So as I said at the beginning of the service, our lectionary is already anticipating Advent. In fact, Advent used to be a longer season, so we're probably in those readings because we were in Advent already, historically. Advent we usually associate with Christmas and the incarnation, that is when God became human, became a baby. And that's, you know, a likely and logical focus for Advent, but historically, the season and the time, the reflection of the church was more about the second coming, as it's called, the return of Christ. All of those things, Jesus' birth, his teaching, his ministry, his death and resurrection, his ascension into heaven, all of those are rear view mirror, right? We look back to them, we celebrate them, there's an ongoing reality of those truths. But this one, the return, is yet to come. And so Advent is very importantly a time of waiting and recognizing how, in fact, we continue to wait. We join those people of God prior to Jesus' coming who are waiting the Messiah. We too are waiting for a fulfillment of the promises of God, though we've got more of that than they did. So this is this time of focus on the return of Christ and God's good purpose being fulfilled entirely, so that a lot of these promises of both the Old Testament and New Testament are yet to really be realized, like lions lying down with lambs, etc., etc., all of these great passages that are so familiar for us, to us. These are all coming. And it's a reminder to the church that we live in light of that hope. I like to use the image, works for me. I don't know if it works for other people. But the image is that there's some rope or cable or some line that goes out. It starts here in my belly, in my spirit. And it goes out beyond the horizon. And that's my identity is being pulled out into that diminishing point. When you look as far as you can see, the line is still going beyond that. And that's my trajectory. That's my identity. My hope is tied up with that. We struggle. The church struggles when it's doing well, when it's rich and comfortable and healthy and wealthy. There's too many things to distract us, too many things to compete with that vision of the future. But the church's true identity is there, yet to be. And so the church that's persecuted, the early church, the first 30, 40 years, the first couple hundred years after Jesus' death and resurrection, knew what it was like to live in that hope. Because often that was all they had. They didn't have anything else except this promise that Jesus gave them. Before all this, you will be persecuted. All men will hate you because of my name. You will. And so that's when hope becomes quite relevant. Anyhow, it's a good reminder for us as the church. Yearly, we need to stop, take stock, and say, we are a people who live by hope. We are an eschatological people. Eschatology, the study of the end. The end is what defines us in important measure, and when we forget that, we lose our sense of being. The church has lost often its way when it began to think about its identity being embedded in this world. And that's an important part of who and what the church is, its mission and its identity. But our true identity is not found here. It's found there. So, anyhow, that's where we're at. Advent, pre-Advent, old Advent, we're here. Our lectionary gave us these readings. I'll tell you when I get there how Thessalonians maps into that potentially as well. Luke does us a great favor. So we get the first part in Luke's gospel, we get the first half of what's called the mini apocalypse. Apocalypse is this Greek word that we translate revelation. So John's revelation, the last book in the Bible, is an apocalypse. And Jesus gives us a little mini apocalypse, and the Matthew, Mark, and Luke record that for us. In Mark and Matthew's gospel, this kind of circles through a couple themes. Luke kind of rearranges the material and breaks it out so that it's clearer that Jesus is talking about three different events. First of all is where we started. What is the sign that this will happen? The temple will be destroyed. And Luke collects the material that was interspersed with Mark's reading about the destruction of Jerusalem. We know that happened AD 70, so roughly 40 years after Jesus' death. Within the lifetime of his listeners, it came to pass that Jerusalem was in fact destroyed and systematically taken apart block by block. And that's where it was for many years. And so Jesus also says before that happens, between now and then, you guys will be persecuted. You will be hunted down and rounded up and thrown into prisons and into the synagogues for judgment. That was the law court for the Jewish people, brought before kings and governors. And now, Luke is writing this in two parts. One is to present Jesus' reliability as a prophet. All of Luke's audience and everybody since then reads this and goes, Jesus called that one right, the destruction of Jerusalem. Jesus called that one right, the persecution of his followers. What we're waiting for, the third piece, Jesus is probably right about that too, wouldn't you say? Anybody who can call that and get that right, we have every confidence in him. Secondly, Luke is trying to make very clear this fulfillment because the book of Acts articulates this, and Acts is the second volume of Luke's book. So like a good author, Luke is giving you hints. He's like, you really got to go out and get volume two. You know, you can't quit here. And he gives us these hints about precisely this, being persecuted, brought before kings and governors, having the wisdom to refute and confound their detractors. You think of Stephen's speech early on in Acts. You think of Peter, this awkward, blustering fisherman who becomes quite eloquent, and et cetera, et cetera. Now, so the church has said you need to think about end times. It's important. You lose your sense of who you are when you lose a sense of the end times. But we know that can get weird too, can't it? This focus on end times. And so the Gospels and the church would agree, I'm pretty sure, that when we remind ourselves of the coming time, it's not so that we might get out our calendar and our newspapers and start predicting things. We're reminded that no one knows the exact time, though we are supposed to be discerning the times. But we discern the times so that we might live appropriately. That's the focus of Jesus and Paul when they teach about end times. The question is, if this is true in light of these truths, how then should you live? So let me ask you this. If you knew today was your last day, what would you do differently? Well, there's a lot of things you would do differently if you knew today was your last day. And in part, the church says you should live in full knowledge that today could very well be your last day. This is the thing that marks out the people of God. They live for then, not for now. And so that's the focus of the church and the scriptures, by reminding us of this eschatology, of this end time, the fact that our identities are tied to that point, that vanishing point in the future, and we're being pulled towards that, or it's being pulled towards us. We're united together. That translates into the question and the answer, how then should you live as people of the future? as people of God, how then should you live? Well, there's three things I want to just touch on briefly from our passages today. All three end with something that's an instruction or a counsel or encouragement for how we should live. All three are dealing with end times or the disruption and the turmoil and the difficulties of those end times. Thessalonians, not so clearly. You may remember last week we read 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, where Paul was teaching specifically about the day of the Lord, the return of the Lord, the end times. And unlike us today, nobody in the ancient world would have heard something last week and then something this week. They would have heard this right bang on the heels of each other, and they would know that the disorderly are probably tied to the end times. And the logic is this. Here's how you might live differently if you knew today was your last day. You might be like, to heck with that, I'm not going into work. I'll call in sick. I'm just going to spend everything. I don't need to worry about bills. Like, get out the credit card. Max it out. I won't be here tomorrow. What's the big deal? And so that's always been a temptation. And the church says, yeah, wrong conclusion. I understand the logic, but not the right conclusion. So that's how this is both eschatological, the passage in Thessalonians, perhaps. Perhaps that's tied together. At any rate, I want to look at these bits of advice. So first of all, Jesus in the gospel says, in the midst of all this turmoil and threat, even some of you being killed, put to death, by your endurance, you will save your souls. And so the first bit of advice is, you need to be steadfast. You need to keep on keeping on. Anybody who's been a teacher knows that at the beginning of class, they have a classroom of straight A students. Everybody's so optimistic. I shouldn't say everybody, but generally speaking, everybody comes in so optimistic, so full of potential, so confident about their ability to succeed. They've made the vow. They're like, this year's going to be different if there needs to be a difference. And then as the year progresses, they start dropping out or start... There's fewer and fewer A students, right? And this is what Jesus is saying. Anybody can start well. Everybody starts well. You remember that? Yahoo, me and Jesus, we got our own thing going. You know? Like, that's it. I mean, it was easy to say no to things and yes to Jesus when you were full of that zeal, you just made choices, your money was their money, you helped, you were generous. And then slowly life gets in the way and we become different people. And some of that's good, some of that's growth. Some of it's just becoming apathetic. The ancients said, you don't know a person's life until you've seen them die. God says the same thing in Ezekiel. He says, if a wicked man repents of his ways, I will call him righteous. If a righteous man leaves off being righteous and begins to do wicked things, I will judge him as wicked. And Jesus just says, you need to stay the course. By that you will save your souls. Now we know we do not save ourselves, right? Don't get me wrong. Sometimes here's what endurance looks like. Jesus, help me. I can't do it, help me. But even that, of course, is an endurance because it's a cry of faith. It's a looking to where your salvation is. When you turn around and you say, I'm done, you know, that's a lack of endurance. But for most of us, the real danger is just the subtle seduction of ease and pleasure and self-indulgence and pride, being offended by people, nursing our grudges. These are the things that take away our endurance. Most of us, if the man came in, the man said, you deny Christ or you're dead. I think most would be like, no crap, gotta do it. Jesus, take me, you know? But that person who could stand there and say that loses their soul through the internet and through bank accounts and toys. Yeah? Endure. By your endurance, you'll save your souls. Thessalonians ends with this. Don't be weary in doing good. And this word weary, which the Old English is faint not, the original Greek concept was cowardice, being a coward, defecting in the face of danger, abdicating your post and your duty in the face of conflict or danger. And it began to mean not being unable strength-wise or resource-wise, but losing the will, losing the heart. The one's summary statement is this: it's a fatigue mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. Does that sound familiar? A fatigue emotionally, mentally, and spiritually. You know what that's like. It's just like, I just can't do anymore. I don't have the drive. I don't have the drive. I don't have the will. I don't have the ability. I can't say yes one more time or whatever it is. It's just being sapped. All done. It's a very real danger for us who do good. Do not be weary in well-doing, says Paul. Because it's a danger. Because that's a possibility. And perhaps it's a possibility because there's these people keep sucking us dry, right? These loafers and idlers, these busybodies that may be tied together. It's there in the same context. Do not become weary. And again, if you're weary, then you need to take that up with Jesus, because he said, the one who comes to me will find rest. The one who takes his yoke upon, my yoke upon himself or themselves, they will find rest. Learn of me. I am meek and lowly of heart. My burden is easy. My load is light. My yoke is light. So there is a rest for the people of God, and our weariness suggests that we're drawing from the wrong stream. Although there are times, I fully believe, when we're just tapped out and God says, that's okay, I got you, you just take a good nap. That's faith too, right? Remember Jesus in the boat? He's the only one sleeping. He gets up, says, where's all your faith, you guys? Sometimes faith looks like being able to take a good nap or two. Then finally, though, in Malachi, I want to mention this concept. So endurance, doing well, are both actions. In Malachi, we get the fear of the Lord, or those who fear his name. And this is the characterization of the righteous. The day of judgment comes, fire, a fiery furnace to burn up the unrighteous with no remainder, root and branch destroyed. But those who fear my name, this will be the Son of Righteousness who rises with healing in his wings. And I think we need to think about this fear of the Lord, because our culture, Christian and non-Christian, is so lopsided today about this whole concept of the fear of the Lord. In part, that's a reaction to people overdoing the fear of the Lord. I get that. One way we can see that is most of the New Testament passages where the fear of the Lord is written in the Greek, we translate that as reverence or awe, which is a good, important way to think about fear, especially about God. But in our culture today, it's way too weak. Whatever's awesome, dude, is not that great, right? We've lost the ability for those words to communicate. The word fear still registers an important meaning, an important effect on us. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, says the Jewish scriptures. The fear of the Lord is what motivates us to endure. The fear, when you fear something, you change your behavior and attitude to be appropriate to the thing you fear. Right? I was Googling examples. I remember seeing sometime footage on a video camera of a guy who's a naturalist. He's out checking out the bears, hanging out with the bears, being a buddy with the bears. And the video is of this shaky sort of thing as a bear is grabbing him and dragging him out of his tent and killing him. I have a very, probably exaggerated fear of bears. Anything that can treat me like I can treat a mosquito, I'm going to be very, very respectful. I'm going to be afraid. I'm going to make sure the choices I make when I'm in an area in which I'm potentially at risk, I mitigate all possible dangers that I have any control over. That's what it means to fear God, is to have an attitude that's appropriate to who He is. In Hebrews, and this is why I think the whole reverence and awe thing is misplaced. The writer of the Hebrews says, let us serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear, for our God is a consuming fire. Our God is a consuming fire. How do you live before the consuming fire? What kind of person should you be? What kind of choices are you supposed to be making? Our God is a consuming fire. That's the truth. Malachi reminds us of this. Those who fear His name encounter Him as a source of healing and righteousness. And that begins this motivation for enduring, for not growing faint. And if we're going to be serious about end times, I think we have to be serious about that quality of what it means to be part of God's people and called into that future. Now, I need to obviously mention this as well. I'm guilty probably of trying to overstress that kind of side of the fear of God, but there's this other fear, and that is the fear the loved one has, the lover has, of offending or disappointing the loved one. I'm so afraid I'm going to disappoint him or her. I spend all this time and energy, and I was this, that. I really hope they like it. Right? You know that. You recognize that voice of love, don't you? I just was hoping so much I could just do something so special for them. And I was afraid that it wasn't going to work. Right? There's the fear of disappointing the loved one. Probably better motivation for y'all, huh? You work that one. You run with that one. Don't think grizzly bear. Think grandma, you know. But it still requires from us choices, and we're motivated. And that's today our invitation by the church. You are a future people. How should you live today in light of that future truth? Will you go about your day mindlessly, sillily, twittering and frittering away the day? Or will you take advantage of the gift of this 24 hours? Of course, you have to watch the Grey Cup. But after that, if our identity is truly tied up there and then, as the scripture tells us, our heart also should be there. May it be so among us. Amen.